we are going to be looking the next 2 or 3, 4, depends upon how hip boot deep we get into the material in here, in Isaiah 24 through 27. 24 through 27. Something I want to show you, but I have to see it so I can show it to you. And that's on this sheet here. We have, or my video for everybody else, we have this sheet, okay? The outline. And please notice on the right hand blue line. You see the right hand blue, not the left hand side, but the right hand side blue. It says against the earth, and then a strong city. Well, it turns out that it could have been against the city of chaos and a strong city. So what I wanted you to see on the 4 chapters we're dealing with, two of them deal with the tearing down of the current city of chaos, and two of them deal with the establishing of a new, a strong city. And so it's kind of got a real system or flow to it right there. Okay, so how do I want to start there? Well, that's how I did start. If I were to say the terms type, anti-type, that's different than body, antibody, or matter, antimatter. It's type, anti-type. What am I talking about? Type, anti-type.
Being one way and then being the opposite of that one way.
Not the opposite, but the fulfillment. The type is the picture that God painted early, and the antitype is the fulfillment of that picture. So in 580, for example, we have the tearing down of the temple in Jerusalem. That was the type of the antitype, which would be the 70 AD tearing down of the temple in Jerusalem. What happened under Nebuchadnezzar was typical of what would happen at the end of the at the end time, at the last. It was typical.
I just read something that it happened on the same day of the year.
That wouldn't surprise. I was unaware of that.
That's true until yesterday.
Now, my point is that as we look here into 24, 5, 6, and 7, we're dealing with a passage of scripture that is sometimes referred to as what, Michael?
The little apocalypse.
The little apocalypse, or Isaiah's apocalypse. See? Or Isaiah's resurrection, or Isaiah's resurrection, or Isaiah's wedding feast, or Isaiah's regathering. All those are terms that pertain to eschatology. And so here is Isaiah's picture of what resurrection would look like, and picture of what the wedding feast of the Lamb would look like, and picture of God gathering his people back to him. Now, I'm just saying that at the get-go, and I hope you'll see it as we go through. Okay? So that's just kind of the introductory salvo. Now let's go ahead and read the first 6 verses of chapter 20. Now, we're not going to do a whole lot of review other than to remind you that chapter 13 and 14 dealt with the Babylon area, what was coming to them. And Babylon was the replacement of Assyria, and Medo-Persia was the one that executed it. But those 2 chapters dealt with God was going to hear of the persecuting powers. But then in end of 14 all the way 23 were the surrounding nations that would be impacted by the Assyrian Babylonian purge scourge down through the Philistine plain, the Palestinian area, all the way to Egypt. So those chapters dealt with, you guys are going to have to face the same problem my people Israel will face, and the answer to all of that was what? Come to Zion. Bring the tribute lamb to Zion. Worship the King of Zion. That's the only place your true security can be found. But now we're looking at Zion, or the city of chaos. You see it called there in verse 10, the city of chaos. And then in verse 12, desolation is left in the city. We're looking now at God punishment of the city, chaos. Let's read beginning at verse 1. Oh, before I start reading, Devin's not online. I was going to ask him a question. In Revelation 13, we read of a beast, of the dragon, the great dragon, had his one foot on the sea and the other foot on the land. Obviously not referring to, I mean, that, and that's the Greek word, gay, which is frequently translated earth, but there clearly, earth as a globe, clearly the dry ground as opposed to the sea. And so the Greek word gay, G-E-G-A-T-A, gamma eta, is the Greek equivalent to the Hebrew word eretz, E-R-E-T-Z. I think it might be S, E-R-E-T-S or E-R-E-T-Z. And it means the same thing, the land. You remember Arlo Guthrie? This
land.
Yeah, this land is your land. This land is, and what was he talking about?
USA.
USA. This land. Okay, so even use it territorially and not universally. Okay, in fact, almost never is the word land used of the globe, but it's the translation of the Greek, of the Hebrew. So when here, behold, Yahweh lays the earth. Read land. Yah lays the land rest. By the way, when Israel left Egypt, where were they headed? When they came out of the, after the 10 plagues crossed the Red Sea, where were they headed? To the promise, what? Land. Eretz. Same word. Okay? So as we read this, I'm going to be reading it with the understanding that this word earth is not referring to the globe, not referring to the what we call planet earth, but it's referring to the land that was the land of the city of chaos. We'll see that down, like I said, down in verses 10, 11, and 12. But let's read now with that picture. Behold, Yahweh lays the earth waste. Devastates, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants. And the people will be like the priest, the servant like his master, maid like her mistress, the buyer like the seller, the lender like the borrower, the creditor like the debtor. The earth land will be completely laid waste and completely despoiled, for Yahweh has spoken this word. The land mourns. Withers, the fades, withers. The exalted of the people of the land fade away. The land is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the land, and those who live on it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the land are burned, and few men are left. All right, now this is a rather intriguing. If you look at my printout of that from my fingers above, you can see how many notes that I've written regarding that. It's just cross-references and places I want to share with you. But first of all, I just want your general impressions as you read that or listened to the reading of what were your general impressions? What were your thoughts? Some specific thoughts. I don't care. What? Just tell me something. Don't make me do all the Babylon or the babbling.
A major destruction.
Major destruction. That's that. Major destruction. devastated, wasted, distorted, burned.
Yes.
They're all what? They all brought down to the lowest level. I mean, when there is a major shakeup in a civilization, there is no hierarchy. You're just all crumbled down. So like, build yourself a deck, a house, and then blow on it, and they're all leveled out. Go ahead.
Richard Wurmbrand was in a Romanian prison for 13 years.
Yeah.
And there was people, the Romanians were Antichrist. They were
opposed. Yeah.
And, huh?
They're opposed to Jesus.
And
yeah.
they were jailing Christian leaders.
Okay.
And he said there was no Catholics, no Pentecostals, no Presbyterians, no Baptists. He says it was only Christians.
Yeah. Richard Wurmbrand wrote the book Tortured for Christ. Okay. Hi, Candy. Welcome. So we just read Isaiah 24, 1 through 6, and we're making observations about it. Do you read it on your phone or do you need a Bible?
No, I've just been going by the sheet.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. All the text is right there on the sheet. Good idea. Except for when I go to Deuteronomy like I will today, and Matthew like I will today.
Just run down.
Yeah. Okay. So we just read the first six verses. We observed that the term earth in there is a reference to not the globe, but the land that curse was applied to. Did you catch anything in the reading that would let you know it was not a universal catastrophic earth burning event?
That the inhabitants of the land had violated the laws. The laws were only given to them.
Yeah, well, you're really close on that. It's they violated the everlasting covenant. Mm-hmm. And there was only one group of people that had the everlasting covenant. See, so that's a really target statement. That's a really targeted statement that what we're dealing with here is something that was going to happen to the people who violated the covenant God made on Sinai with them. As Jeremiah 31 following observed, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their fathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant they broke, even though I was to them. So I'm going. Jeremiah, which is 100 years later, we need a new covenant, but that's not unusual. Hosea, who was contemporary with Isaiah, also spoke of a new covenant. So we're going to have a new covenant. And anyway, so this is dealing with the covenant people. Also, if you noticed in verse 1, it didn't say the inhabitants were incinerated. It said they were scattered. So this was not a terminus of earth life, global earth life. This was some kind of devastation that reduced everybody to the same level. Linda picked up on that. I'm glad she did. There in verse 2, also that scattered people. Now, have you know of anything where God said, my people will be scattered? Deuteronomy what? Yes, 28. Deuteronomy 28 is that parallel to Leviticus 26. It's a passage where, now, Leviticus 20 was given to the people that came out with Moses. Deuteronomy 28 was given to their children 40 or 20 years later. But it's the same thing. It's blessings if you follow me, the curses if you don't. And so in Deuteronomy 28, God clearly warned. I want to look at Deuteronomy 28 and verse 64. I'll be coming to Deuteronomy 28 a couple times probably in this session, because what we're dealing with in Isaiah 4 is really a development of Moses' thoughts in Deuteronomy 28 through 32. So in Deuteronomy 28, verse 64, see the curses begin at verse 1, the curses begin at verse 15. So 1 through 4 blessing, 15 through 68, 15 through 68 are the curses, or what would happen because of. So in verse 64, Mo Yahweh will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the land to the other end. And there you will serve other gods, wood, stone, which you fathers have not known, and you will not find rest. Now, I want to fast forward with that thought in mind to chapter 30 of Deuteronomy. So just turn the page. Oh, that's a different book. In Deuteronomy 30 says in verse 1, so then when all these things have come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before you, and you call to mind in all the nations where Yahweh your God has banished you, and you return to Yahweh your God and obey him with all your heart and soul. That's Deuteronomy 6. Hear, O Israel, what does God require? Love the Lord your God with all your mind. Okay. And you come back to him and revere him, obey him with heart and soul, according to all that I command you today, you and your sons, then Yahweh your God will restore you from captivity, have compassion on you, gather you again from all before Yahweh has scattered you. Now drop down to verse 6, where your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul, in order that you may live. Now, does anybody have any thoughts on this idea of God circumcising people's hearts?
Romans.
Okay. And so I was thinking of Colossians, actually.
Oh.
Scott agrees with me. How do you know what I was thinking? Oh, in Colossians 2. Is it two or is it three?
I didn't know it was in the office.
That, Linda, this is a really important thought you just brought up. That almost everything we read in the New Testament is a fulfillment of the promises. That the New Testament is just God saying, here's how I kept my promise to you. Oh, and by the way, you Gentiles can come in too. In chapter two, beginning, we're talking about Jesus. In verse 9, it says, in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in him, verse 10, you have been made complete, and he is the head over all rule and authority. And in him, verse 11, you also were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands. Colossians 2:11. Now, anytime you read that something is done without hands, like the stone in Daniel 2. I saw a stone carved without hands hit the statue in the feet. In Hebrews, we read of a tabernacle that was made by man's hand, but a new one that was made without hands. Anytime you read "made without hands," what are you expected to think? Is God doing it? Okay, so here's a circumcision made without hands. Now, God isn't really about the fleshy tissue on a person's body, but he is concerned about something.
Yes.
Your heart. Yeah. What do we read in Deuteronomy 30? See, verse 2, return and obey him with all your heart. And then Lord God, Yahweh your God will circumcise your heart. Here in Colossians 2, in verse 11, in him, in Jesus, you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in the removal of the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism. How important is baptism? Yes, circumcision takes place, where God cuts the old man off of our heart. Not beating that bush too badly, too deeply. All I'm saying is, in this verse back in Isaiah 24, verse 1, the scattering of the inhabitants, we saw that in Deuteronomy 28. But in Deuteronomy 30, we see God bring them back. But we see the fulfillment of that promise in Colossians 2. So that helps us nail down the period of time we're looking at, doesn't it? Of the fulfillment of this Isaiah prophecy. As challenging as it is, there are a lot of places we can find this is how I know what he's talking about. And that was one of them, the scattering and the regathering. Okay, now you've already noticed on verse 2, and I really, really appreciate the simplistic but thorough way that Linda nailed it for us. And that is, everybody is going to be brought to the same level, whether you're the buyer or the seller, whether you're the priest or the people, whether you're the maid or the mistress, everybody brought to the same level. And basically, when you have a devastation reading about in verse 1, what level is that? If we're all brought to the same level, yeah, we're all scrounging around the ground, just trying to stay, hide me in the caves, something to eat, something to wear, just really brought down to the lowest possible level. Okay? Now, on the scattering and regathering, there's a verse, a very important verse that I want you, I mean, we connected Deuteronomy 28 with Deuteronomy 30 and then also to Colossians 2. But I want you to connect Deuteronomy 28 also with Matthew 23. And I'll show you what I'm thinking there. In Deuteronomy 28, it says in verse 64, you will be scattered. And what we saw in chapter 30 is gathered, right? You're scattered, and then later you'll be gathered. Look at what Jesus said in the end of Matthew 23. Oh, Jerusalem, verse 37. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem who kills the prophets, stones those who are sent to her. How often I want to gather you to me the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. There was a scattering of the people of God and a prompt regathering of the people of God. That's a very, very important theme, the gathering. In the book of Hebrews, the Hebrews writer said in chapter 10, not forsaking that gathering. I'm not talking about going to church. He's talking about being part of those people that God brought back to him. That was a singular event in history of God gathering his people. And those people in Hebrews were on the verge of just bailing out because of it was of the pressure. Don't forsake this. It's too precious. But at that, he's talking about a particular gathering, bringing God's people back to him. All right? Now, 3. Wow, we're making progress. 20 minutes and we got 2 verses. Verse 3. The land will be completely laid waste, completely despoiled, for Yahweh has spoken this word. Now we saw in, was it chapter 11 at verse 9, was it? Or was it chapter 9? No, it's chapter 9, verse 7. When he talked about a child being born, verse 6, a son given, holding, having the dominion. All of this would happen because the zeal of Yahweh of hosts will accomplish it. I'm going to keep my word. In fact, Alan, what you're going to discover as we get into the second half of Isaiah from chapter 40 verse on, chapter 40 verse 1 on, chapter 40 and forward, is that the evidence that God, Yahweh, is the world savior that you can find in he keeps his word. He makes his word come to pass. If he, it is going to happen. Not if he promises, well, it might happen. It's going to happen. And so here in Isaiah 24, so verse 3, Yahweh has spoken this word. Now, what word has spoken? Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. If you will not keep my covenant, you will be scattered and devastated and brought low. Whereas you were of the sand of the sea for number, you will be a handful. Okay. And I really want Deuteronomy 28. Just really want you to read that, but we're not going to take, like I said, 65 verses long. Okay. Now, why did God speak this word? That's what I was just getting at, but I want you to iterate it for me. Why did God speak this word regarding the land?
To make them more, he's
it's
a promise.
All coming together, is it? Pardon, Michael?
He's a promise-keeping God. He had been for his father.
He's a promise-keeping God, but I'm not looking at God as much as I'm looking at the people. What? It's a judgment on the people because of the curses of Deuteronomy 28. They violated the everlasting covenant, we see in verse 5. But we understand that they wouldn't be scattered unless they had Deuteronomy 8 violated the covenant and not covenant. And so God spoke, yeah. Now, I have some interesting thoughts here for you. Why was it, and Michael, you'll know this, why was it that when in Genesis 15, when God promised the land to Abraham, he said, you can't have it now? Why couldn't, if you're going to give it to me, why not just give it to me? Why couldn't he give it to him at that point in time? Say it loud enough.
Because the iniquity of the Gentiles was not fulfilled.
The iniquity of the Amorite was not yet full. Genesis 15, verse 16. God promises 400 years from now, they'll come back. It's going to take that long for that the people living there to become so corrupt that God had to remove them. Now, we kind of get that picture, but I want you to look over here in Leviticus 18 with me. Leviticus 18. Now, it's kind of a gruesome chapter, and really it's dealing a lot of sexual perversion. And it just seems like when a people get unrestrained by the guidance of God, that is a drive that takes over their lives. But he says here in verse 24, Leviticus 18, 20, do not defile yourselves by any of these things. For by all these, the nations which I am casting out before you have become defiled. Now, Genesis 16, 15, I can't cast them out now because their iniquity isn't full. Because I'm casting them out now. What does that tell you, Alan? If you can't cast them out because their iniquity isn't full, but now I'm casting them out, then the iniquity is full. But let's keep reading. For the land has become defiled, therefore I have visited punishment upon it, so the land has vomited out its inhabitants. New American Standard says spew is vomit. I can't think they're trying to. That's, I'm in Leviticus 18, 24 through 6, that was 25. Verse 25 again, for the land has become defiled. There's the word land. Has become defiled, therefore I have visited it and upon it. So the land has vomited out its inhabitants. But as for you are to keep my statutes and my judgments, and you shall not do any of these abominations, nor the native or the alien who sojourns among you. So, verse 28, so that the land might not vomit you out. Now, we're reading here in Isaiah 24. The land's getting ready to vomit its inhabitants out. Not the ones that were there when Israel came to the promised land, but it's themselves who lived on it. Getting ready to vomit them out. And then we come over to Matthew 23 and verse 32. As Jesus is talking about the tearing down of the temple. Your house is left to you desolate, he said at the end of verse of chapter 23. Behold, your house is left to you desolate. The disciples went out and said, look, as they looked at, look at these magnificent stones. And Jesus said, what about those magnificent stones? Not one stone shall be left upon another that will not be torn down. They said, when? And he basically says, when the Roman army comes in and tears the temple down. Okay, now look all of that to set you up to help to read verse 31 and 32. He says to the scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you bear witness against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. You're going to murder the ones I send you. Fill up then the fear of your fathers. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how shall you escape the sentence of Gehenna? Now, you know what the sentence of Gehenna was? That's what happened when Nebuchadnezzar stormed Jerusalem. The only way they had to bury anybody was to toss them over the wall into Gehenna, the valley of the sun. He says, you're going to suffer the same thing because you have filled up. See that? Fill up then the sins of your fathers. What did he promise them back in Leviticus 18? If you defile this place, the land will vomit you out just like it vomited those who were before you. And here Jesus saying you have filled up the measure of your sins. We can draw the conclusion that the rest of chapter 4, 24 of Matthew says judgment coming upon the nation. Okay. Can you see? I know there's a lot of meat on this bone, and it's good chewy meat, but it's also easy to kind of get lost in it. Go ahead. You look like you're ready to say something.
I guess because we've gone over it so many times, it just is refreshing.
Yeah, the picture is becoming more refreshed again and clearer. Yeah. So I'm of the opinion that Matthew, I'll get it right. Third time's a charm. Isaiah 24 through 27. Talking about the same thing that Jesus was in Matthew 23 and 24. Thing that John was in the entire book of Revelation. Same thing. The judgment that was coming upon Israelites because they, verse 5, violate or broke the everlasting covenant. But let's look back, okay? Verse 4. The earth mourns, the land mourns and withers. The world, the land, the world. In Greek, the word world is cosmos, KOSMOS or kappa omicron sigma mu omicron sigma cosmos, and it means. Rachel, do you use cosmetics? Most women do, and it has to do with making an orderly arrangement of your physical appearance, putting things in order. And that's what the word cosmos means, an orderly arrangement. Now, what was it in any society, an orderly arrangement? What brings order to a chaotic society? The rule of law brings order to a chaotic society. World is frequently used in the New Testament to refer to the world of Judaism and the order that the law of Moses brought to a people who had no God when they went, or no national God when they went into Egypt. And I wonder if that's not the way it's being used here, because it's being used synonymously with land. Land was the territory, world was the ordered society on that territory. Okay, but land is territory, kind of like my son would come up to me and say, hey, can I borrow the wheels? What's he really wanting to borrow? The car, right? And so the part put for the whole or representative. So I think we're talking about the Jewish society here. And it fades away and withers, and the exalted people of the land fade away. In, I think it's Ezekiel 5:5. God says, I put you in the center of the, I just put you in the center. And the idea was, I want my light to shine through you to everybody. Jesus said in Matthew 4, no, Matthew 5, you are light of the world. You are the light of the, and so here it's fading. You see that there in verse 4? And the exalted people of the earth fade away. The land is also polluted by inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws. They have violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Now, what's the difference between a law and a statute and a covenant? You see how I've misdirected you? The real issue is, what was the people's attitude toward being governed by God? See, that's really the point of all that. It's not to try to distinguish between law and statute and covenant. But the relationship they had of following God, they just violated. When you read that broke the everlasting covenant, that's what tells us that we're dealing here with the transgression of the law of Moses and the curse that came because of that. Now, the idea of a curse, go
That
ahead.
everlasting covenant, that is conditional.
Everlasting always was.
Yes, and most a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
They think that is forever and ever.
Did you know that I can prove from the Bible that forever is 3 days? I can. In Jonah 2, verse 6, he says, I was at the bottom of the earth forever. And he uses the word forever. But I know he's only there 3 days.
It felt like forever, though.
Well, and then a man who is a servant and he loves his master, and the master gave him a wife. And if he goes free after 7, the wife and kids stay behind. So I love my master. I love my wife. He can say, I want to be that man's servant forever and go to the door post and have an awl stuck through his ear, and he's a slave forever. How long is forever in that case? Till he dies. What I'm really trying to say is the word forever does not have the connotation that we put on it, that it just never ends. The word forever always meant as long as this condition applies. And so the priests were priests forever. The priesthood changed. Okay, so that's really all that it can mean. All that it can mean. The everlasting covenant doesn't mean that the covenant of Moses is going to last to the end of, because 100 years later, and in fact, I already pointed out that Hosea in chapter 2 said, I'm going to make a new covenant with him. And Jeremiah repeated that. And it's quoted in Hebrews 8 and says, we've got to make, if the first covenant had been perfect, there was no place looked for a second, but finding fault with them, the people, we need to give them a covenant that they won't break. They can't break. So, but it was an everlasting covenant because it lasted as long as God intended it to. Now, that opens the door to another study. And what did God intend by that covenant, by that Mosaic covenant? And you can read Galatians and Romans and get some insight into what God intended to accomplish with that covenant. And once that was accomplished, fait accompli. And we can put an end to, and that's why God said, I'm going to make a new covenant, not like the one they broke, even though I was their husband. And that's another interesting thing. Okay, they broke the everlasting covenant. Mentioned Hebrews 8, verses 8 and 9 on that point. You might want to write down Hebrews 8, verses 8 and 9. I'm going to make a new covenant. But he's quoting Jeremiah 31, 31 and following. Jeremiah chapter 31, beginning at verse 31, and the next 6 or 7 verses is quoted in Hebrews 8, beginning at verse 8, and quoted down through verse 12, I think. And so I'm going to make a new covenant. Well, that's the Jeremiah passage. But in the Jeremiah passage, he says, although I was a husband to them. Did you know that the covenant of Mount Sinai was a covenant of marriage? That's where God married his bride. Since when there's a new covenant, we're not waiting for the end of, we're not waiting till the end of time for Jesus to marry his bride. That covenant was a covenant of marriage. That's what God made. And so we're not saying we're waiting to get married to Jesus. We already are. We already are. And that's why I say this is Isaiah's presentation of the marriage. And we'll see some of that, I think, at the end of chapter 25, the marriage feast is there, which will connect up with Revelation 19. Okay. Monumental stuff. This is really great stuff. And I'm not going to get all the way to chapter 25, verse 5 tonight, am I? Didn't
I
think
get done with 24.
I might not even get done with verse 6. Well, it's, yeah, and that's the beauty of Isaiah. I've often said Isaiah is like trying to trace the threads in Isaiah is like trying to trace the threads in a very beautifully knit doily, intricate and beautiful and intertwined. You can do it, but it takes a while. It takes focus. Okay, so we have this everlasting covenant. Did I give you Ezekiel 16:8 yet?
No,
I just
yeah.
did, didn't I? In Ezekiel 16, I can't develop the story, but it's the story about God taking Israel out of Egypt. And Egypt, Israel did not have a covenantal God yet. In fact, when did they make a covenant with God? At Mount Sinai. And so it's a picture of a young woman at the point of being married, but having nobody to cover her. Remember how Ruth was told to go to the harvest and then uncover Boaz's feet, and then he would spread his covering over her. That's a picture of taking her into protection. Okay, so here's this naked, uncovered, woman, and then it says in verse 8, then I passed by you, I, Yahweh, passed by you, and behold, and saw you, and behold, you were at the time for love, so I spread my skirt over you. See, that's a picture of bringing you into my covering and protection. Kind of reminds me of what Jesus said in Matthew 3, how I wanted to gather you to myself, but you weren't willing. Hey, Chris, verse 8, halfway through. Okay, spread my view, covered your nakedness. I also swore to you and entered into a covenant with you so that you became mine. See, she was at the age to be married. She wasn't married. I covered you. I spread my skirt over you, covered your nakedness, and made a covenant with you, and you became mine. And so this idea of being married to God through that covenant, it says, and they broke it. One of the charges, Isaiah doesn't go into it near as much as Ezekiel and Jeremiah do, but the idolatry was pictured as what?
Breaking
the covenant. Adultery.
Adultery.
My wife with another God. It was the way God looked at it, okay? And so, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse. Now, if I wanted to read about where that curse would, where would I go? Blessings and curses, yeah. Nailed it, Linda. Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28. I think by the time we finish, the prophets, not just Isaiah, but those two passages are going to be emblazoned on your mind. Just emblazoned there. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. In fact, if you go to Leviticus 26, it'll probably refer you to Deuteronomy 28 and vice versa. Probably. So all you really need to do is remember one of them, right? or you could go to Galatians 3 where it says Jesus became a curse. And you probably find it. You go back and find it. Anyway, here in Isaiah 24, for a curse devours the land, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the land are burned. Now, we read up in verse 1, it's laid waste, it's devastated, it's distorted and scattered. Here, they're burned. The inhabitants of the land are burned. And what? And what?
Yeah.
A few men are left. That's another reason I know that this is not dealing with an end of the world theophany. There's a few men left. They've been scattered, and there are a few. What's another word for "and a few are left"?
Remnant.
Remnant. Okay. Do you remember what we saw back in chapter 4 of Isaiah? In chapter Isaiah 4, it says about the branch, and that day the branch would be glorious in verse 2. And the fruit of the a land will be pride, the adornment of the survivors of Israel. No, come of he who is left in Zion and remains Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who's recorded for life in Jerusalem. There's that remnant. You saw at least three times that he mentioned left and remains and then recorded for life. Have you ever see anything in the New Testament about being recorded for life? It's multitude of places. We read about the Lamb's Book of Life in the Book of Revelation, but we also read about those who are recorded for life in Philippians. Jesus talked about, don't rejoice that the spirits are subject to, but rejoice that your names are written there. And so it's throughout the book. The idea of people who are recorded for citizenship in heaven. Paul, didn't he say in Philippians 3, our citizenship is in heaven. There is a census. And boy, how the Holy Spirit doesn't want you to lose your census about that one.
Two
verses, Isaiah 4, verses 2 and 3 and 4. Isaiah 4, 2, 3 and 4. I'm going to go back to Deuteronomy 29. There's a thought I want to pick up for you. And then we can have some discussion if you want, but I don't want to progress farther. I won't be able to finish the chapter, so I might as well stop with the paragraph. But in Deuteronomy 29, let's just read 22 beginning. It says, now the generation to come, your sons who rise up after you, and the foreigner who comes from a distant land, when they see the plagues of the land and the diseases with which Yahweh has afflicted it, will say, all its land is brimstone and salt, a burning waste, unsown, productive. Now, what did we read here in Isaiah? The inhabitants of the earth are burned, few men are left in it. Up in verse 1, devastated, distorted, scattered. Says, when offspring see that, and it looks like Sodom and Gomorrah, Adma and Zeboim, Yahweh overthrew in his angry wrath, and all the nations shall say, why has Yahweh done thus to this land? Why this great outburst of anger? Then they'll say, because they forsook the covenant of Yahweh, the God of their fathers. Do you see how it looks like we're reading Isaiah 24 when we're reading Deuteronomy 29? What does that tell you? Rachel, what does that tell you? If it looks like Isaiah 29 is what we're seeing in Isaiah, or Deuteronomy 29 looks like what we're seeing in Isaiah 24, what does that tell you?
It's important.
I love it. It is important. What else?
It's consistent.
Type any
it's
consistent. Type.
Okay. What else? Almost like a, how about prediction and fulfillment?
Yeah.
Or a prediction echoed? Because this is not the fulfillment in Isaiah. It's an echo of what's coming. Consistent is really a good word. That God hasn't changed his mind. God is listening to this. I also want you to see that Moses was the source of Isaiah's message. Isaiah's message is really built upon an understanding of the covenant that they've transgressed. So let's keep reading. And all the nations, why has Yahweh done thus to this land? Verse 24. Why this great outburst of anger? Then they shall say, because they forsook the covenant of Yahweh, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. And they went to gods and worshiped them, gods whom they have not known and whom he had not allotted to them. Therefore, the anger of Yahweh burned against that land to bring upon it every curse which is written in this book. You see why I could go and look at this word curse here in Isaiah 24 and say that's Deuteronomy 28. That's what Moses said would happen. I want you to see the consistency of God. I want you to see that this is not just something where God is scratching his head and saying, what can I do now? How long between Deuteronomy and Isaiah? Any idea? How many years between Deuteronomy and Isaiah? When would you place Deuteronomy? About 1500 BC, yeah. And Isaiah is 700 BC, 800 years. 800 years. And how long has the United States been occupied by white people?
15, 12.
Yeah, not counting. What's that guy's name? Leif?
Oh, yeah.
Erickson, not counting him. But yeah, when did Columbus come across? 1492.
1492, but
Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
1512.
1512. Anyway, what are we talking about? At the max, 500 years, 300 years shy of the time between when Isaiah, when Moses spoke it the first time, and Isaiah reiterated it. I want you to understand just how consistent God is. His blessing can be relied upon, and his threats can be relied upon. Okay?
To show us his patience.
Yeah. How long did he wait to bring this about? Yeah, good point. Anything else that you have to observe? Let me I got a thought. I want to connect it to the later portions of Isaiah. And we may come back to it when we get there. But in here it says, a few men are left, a few men are left. In chapter 65 of Isaiah, chapter 65. Beginning about verse 13, we have this. Therefore, thus says the Lord Yahweh, behold, servants shall eat, but you shall be hungry. Now I could read on, but there's something right there that I want you to take good note of. Behold, my servant shall eat, but you shall be hungry. To whom was Isaiah writing?
Was all God first one?
This book was addressed to the entire nation, wasn't it? My servant shall eat, Yahweh says. You should be hungry.
The remnant is my servant.
The remnant, see, this message was directed toward Israel, but only a remnant. We have here in verse 6, a few are left. But here in Isaiah 65, you got my servants and you. And my servants represent the few, and you represent the majority. Go ahead.
It just that whenever God talks about Israel being saved, he's never talking about the whole, not once is he talking about the whole nation.
I appreciate you bringing that up because that's a bugaboo in Romans 11, where it says that all Israel shall be saved. And the emphasis is on all, but it should be on thus. This is all Israel saved. In this manner, by being grafted back in through faith, the only way anybody in Israel and the only way anybody in the Gentile world will be saved is to be grafted into the rich root of the promised land.
Which leads to that. Who is, what is Israel?
Yeah, but even if you're talking about, and I think Paul was, at least the indication is he's answering the argument, well, what about Israel? Well, this is how all Israel is going to be saved. It's like that passage in Acts 15. And
We are saved in
we Jews are saved the same way they are, the Gentiles. Yeah. And so the way anybody in Israel or anybody in the world will be saved is to be grafted in to the rich root of the promise made to Abraham. And that was Paul's point in Isaiah.
Galatians talks about that the Gentiles were saved the same way Abraham was.
Yeah, Romans 4 does as
Yeah.
well. Yeah. Hey, oh, I'm looking to see if I got so much written down here, but I think we covered everything I got written down through verse 6. Who knew that it would take that long? I suspected it. I suspected it, which means we're stretching the study in Isaiah out at least another week. Yeah, right. You notice the power of the word at least. At least another week. Any thoughts or comments? Anybody online on the screen want to weigh in and share?
Rod, I will. It's,
Okay, Michael, but that louder, you're barely coming through.
okay, I get the microphone closer if that's better.
I think I'm getting nod, heads nodding. They can hear you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The depth of what you're going through and linking, like you said, all the different offshoots that are, and tying them all back together, that helps to give the perspective of the whole total story that he's trying to give here to the Jews, and for our benefit also.
Now, what Michael just said is so important for this reason. Not understanding this thing will open the New Testament and find concepts there and construct an understanding. And so we have an understanding of the direction, we have an understanding of the wedding, we have an understanding of the gathering that is inconsistent with these thoughts upon which they're built. So, how important is it to have thoughts upon which the New Testament is built? We had the observation over here about, and my response was almost the entire New Testament is showing God keeping his promises. Almost every, and maybe with exception, every parable of Jesus is telling the story promise made in the Old Testament. It's not introducing anything new. It's showing how, for the people that he was speaking to, how they could expect their promises to be fulfilled for them. And when we look at the New Testament that way, as being explaining to his people, and we're looking over their shoulders. We're invited to come be part of his people, but this was a story to his people. How he was keeping his promises. That we're really going to understand and make sense out of and make a unified sense out of the message of the New Testament. Thank you for that, Michael. Gave me a platform to whatever it was I just did. Expound on, yes.
Yeah, it's important.
Yeah, I think it is.